702. The Naked Scientist.
It is 25 minutes to 3, and that's all that we have. 25 minutes with Chris Smith, our Naked Scientist. Dial now already, 011-883-0702, and pose your questions to the Naked Scientist, who is joining us via Skype. Good afternoon, Chris.
Hello.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, we are fine. We are doing our best during this COVID-19 period. We are hoping that very soon we're going to be going down to level, I don't know, 2-1, whatever it is, to normal life, so to speak. And how are you guys doing?
Well, pretty much the same, although unlike South Africa, where your next stop is going to be summer, our next stop is going to be winter. And usually viruses become a lot worse in winter than they are in summertime. So we regard ourselves as sort of in the eye of the storm at the moment. We've bought ourselves important breathing space by using a lockdown at enormously exorbitant price, of course. And that has eased things. But now we're into the situation where we are going to head towards winter. We know that virus infections become a lot worse in winter, not just from coronavirus, which inevitably will increase, but also all the other infections that come seasonally, like the flu, for example. Yeah. And these will put enormous pressure on an already stressed system. And so we're desperately trying to come up with ways that we can anticipate where the threats and the pressures are going to be and how we control for that. And at the same time, we're trying to get the country back to normal.
Yeah.
And that includes opening up schools. And we know that schools are places where infections do tend to spread and propagate and proliferate quite well, largely because it's large groups of people who are susceptible to infection all in one place. And therefore, there are concerns being expressed about what impact the opening of schools may have for a resurgence in coronavirus cases, and how we anticipate and try to mitigate against that as well. So it's a tricky time, and of course there's no gold standard. It's not like we've got loads of experience of doing this, because we have never been in this position with a virus like this, and the world having no collective experience of it like this. So it's very, very testing times.
It's a first for all of us, and I'm going to kickstart this this section, Chris, if you don't mind, by asking this question. And maybe you've been asked this question before. I'm not sure. If you have, please pardon me. But for me, it's about medicine and how it works. How does medicine know where to go? For example, when you've got a headache and you take a Grandpa, how does Grandpa or Panado or whatever aspirin know where to go?
Yeah, and before I went to medical school, I asked myself the very same question. How does the pill know where the pain is?
Yes.
And the answer is it doesn't. But what happens is that the pill blocks up a process. And if we take aspirin as a really good example, aspirin blocks an inflammatory process that leads to the creation of molecules called prostaglandins. Mm-hmm. And prostaglandins sensitize nerve endings and they make pain. They also make other elements of inflammation, and they attract the immune system to an area. What aspirin does is it inhibits the chemicals that are involved in making prostaglandins. And they don't just do that where you've got injury. They do it everywhere. So all around your body, when you've popped a pill, you are basically suppressing the ability of your tissues to get inflamed. And you're doing it everywhere. But because you're not painful everywhere, you're painful only where you have an injury or some kind of infection or some other problem, you notice the effect there, because that's where the pain was, and it takes the pain away. But the pill isn't that bright. It doesn't know where to go. It works everywhere. It has so-called off-target effects, and this is the basis for drug side effects. Drugs aren't that intelligent, or at least the drugs we've made hitherto aren't that intelligent. They are non-specific in their actions. They will hit everything, everywhere equally. And what the new generation of medicines are trying to do is be much more selective about their actions. You make drugs that do know where the pain is and can home in on it, and you do that by using specific chemical addresses. For instance, the next generation of cancer therapies that we're now making, they look for specific markers on cancer cells that mean that instead of hitting all cells in the body and causing side effects of chemotherapy, which we're familiar with, things like people losing their hair, sore mouth, sore tummy, feeling very tired, you can make the drug get delivered and have its action only on the cancer cells, and as a result, only the cancer is hurt and the rest of the body is spared. So that's the next generation that's coming along now. But the older generation of drugs didn't know where the pain was, they didn't know where the disease was, had non-specific effects everywhere, but you only tended to notice the effects where it hurt most because the pain went away.
Well, that's the question that kept me awake at night, Chris. Well, let's hear from Janine in Lingsville. What question do you have for the Naked Scientist?
Hello, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
Chris, I have been on selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors for a long time. Okay, and it's obviously for depression, as you would know. Now, having explained all that stuff before, mine obviously takes the serotonin and must move it from cell to cell. Is that correct?
Hi, Janine. The way that SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, work is that your nerve cells that use serotonin as a chemical to talk from one nerve cell to another have a limited amount of serotonin in the nerve. And when the nerve fires and sends a message to its neighbors, it releases a small amount of that serotonin from one nerve ending onto the surface of the other nerve. Now, if you just left it like that, it would continue to stimulate the other nerve indefinitely. So the body has a way of dealing with this. And one way is to break down the serotonin. That would be a bit wasteful. So another way of dealing with it is it has almost like a vacuum cleaner on the nerve ending that releases the serotonin, and it reaches out, grabs the stuff it's just produced, and pulls it back inside the nerve. Effectively, it recycles it, and it can be reused. But this has the benefit and the effect of blunting or interrupting or causing to cease the signal. So you produce the signal and it's only short-lived because you pull the serotonin back into the nerve again. But when you take an SSRI, it basically blocks up a bit that process that would scavenge the serotonin cell. And this means that the signal is increased. It can see the target nerve cell and stimulate it for a bit longer, and therefore that's effectively increasing the serotonin signal, and that corresponds, we think, with the mood-altering effects and the improvement in depression symptoms when a person takes these drugs.
Thanks, Chris. And we're going to go straight to Poloso in Woodmead. Poloso, your question to Chris.
Hello. I would like to know, with regard to G-force, what kills you in G-force? Is it deprivation of oxygen? And then, is it possible for someone to recover from a Z impact, and how long does it take for it to be fatal, if prolonged?
These sorts of questions become very important when we're considering things like supersonic travel, space travel, recovering astronauts back from the International Space Station, where they may be subjected to extreme G-forces. Pilots, for example, who are flying very fast jets are also subject to these effects. What happens is that under normal circumstances, when I'm sitting talking to you, my heart is filling with blood, which is coming up from my legs, flowing into my veins, and then it's filling the heart with a certain amount of blood. It contracts, pushing that blood out and back around my body, including critically to my brain. If, though, you accelerated me away from the direction in which I'm sitting, so you literally picked me up very quickly, The blood would be left behind in my blood vessels a bit. Because the blood is not fixed in the blood vessels would move, but the blood would be left behind. It would pool in my legs. And this would have the effect of reducing the so-called venous return into my heart. So in other words, the heart would be filled with a bit less blood all the time that acceleration was going on. And if there's less blood going into the heart, there's less blood for the heart to pump out. And that means that if there's less blood being pumped out, there's less blood filling the arteries. And if you've got less blood filling the arteries, you've got lower blood pressure overall. And if you have lower blood pressure, you get lower blood flow. And that means lower oxygen flow and oxygen delivery to vital tissues like your brain. And that's why pilots have various maneuvers that they use to maintain the return of blood back up their legs and into their heart, so that even though they're pulling these maneuvers, they don't lose consciousness, at least initially. One trick they use is to plug themselves into a special air supply that comes off the jet engine, which is connected to their flight suit, and the flight suit inflates. So when the pilot pulls a particular maneuver that has very high G, the air is pushed into the suit and it squeezes around the lower legs, for example, helping the blood to be pushed back up the body and maintaining that essential venous return to make sure that the person can maintain blood and therefore oxygen flow to their brain. They also do various breathing maneuvers. They will increase and decrease accordingly the pressure in their thorax, because if you increase the pressure in your thorax, you can squeeze more blood out. You can also encourage more blood to come back to your heart if you decrease the pressure. So pilots understand and train intensively in these maneuvers, as do astronauts, in order to know what the symptoms are, how to recognize when you're going to gray and then black out, and how to mitigate them. And this is called blacking out because when it happens, you just lose consciousness because your brain is deprived of oxygen and you cannot function. Your brain has such a high metabolic rate, despite contributing only about 2% to your body mass. It accounts for about a fifth of the oxygen that you use all the time in any moment in time. So it's very, very metabolically hungry. And the minute you drop the blood supply to the brain, you develop these symptoms. And you can tell they're going to come because you get this graying at the edge of the vision. And pilots will talk about gray vision or graying out. And when they know this is coming, this tells them that they're at risk of blacking out. So they start to do some of these maneuvers and hopefully can get their blood flow up enough to stop it or give them enough time to get out of the maneuver that's causing it. And then things will go back to normal.
Happy with that answer, Poloso?
Yeah, very fast. Much.
Great stuff. Thank you so much for calling. And Cindy is on the line. Cindy out of Soweto. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Tejo. I have a quick question and then I'll listen on the radio if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind
at all. I'd like to know what is the difference between distilled water and hydrogen water, and on each of these waters, what is the pH level supposed to be?
Oh, hello, Cindy. Right. Well, distilled water, when you distill something, what you do is you raise the stuff above its boiling point or to its boiling temperature. So if we're talking about water, that's 100 C. And at 100 C, you're giving enough energy to the water that the molecules can break the bonds that are holding the molecules together and they become vapor. And then you get water vapor, which is steam. You collect the water vapor, condense it on a cold surface. The cold surface is basically taking the excess energy away again. And if you take the energy away, the water molecules move close together again, stick back together, form droplets, and ultimately a liquid. Now, the amount of energy you need to get water to do that is much lower than the amount of energy that you need to get dissolved salts and other impurities to do that. So when you distill the water, you get just pure water vapor, and you don't get salts. So as a result, distilled water is also known as deionized water because it doesn't contain any salts. The pH of that distilled water should be around about the 7 mark, but because there are things in the air that can dissolve in the water, this includes CO2, and there's not much CO2 in normal room air, but there's a bit, and that can dissolve in the water, and CO2 is very slightly acidic, as so is nitrogen dioxide and nitric oxide, nitrous oxide. And as a result, they can impart a little bit of acidity to the water, so the water may be just slightly under the 7 mark. I've never heard of hydrogen water. That sounds like a marketing ploy or something. Of course, the formula of water is H2O, and you make it by burning a molecule of hydrogen and a molecule of oxygen. In fact, you burn two molecules of hydrogen and a molecule of oxygen, so 2H2 plus 1O2 goes to 2H2O, two molecules of water. If you did it that way, you would have pure water as well, because there'd be nothing else there in the mixture, and the result would be pure water.
Happy, Cindy?
Okay. Yes, happy. Thank you.
Great stuff. Thank you so much, and have a good afternoon further as we move over to Tessa in Joburg. What's your question for Chris, Tessa?
Hi, I've actually got two questions, Seho and Dr. Smith. Hello.
Hello, Tessa. Very greedy. Two questions, but we'll see what we can do. Have a go.
The first one is, in hindsight, I've never been tested, but just after lockdown, I had a lot of symptoms which I can now relate to COVID. I had ringing in my ears, constant headache, nausea, fever, no cough or anything, total loss of appetite. In 2 weeks, I lost 12 kilograms. is there any way of being tested to find out if I had COVID? And the other question is, in 2015, I was diagnosed with myoclonic dystonia. This was controlled with medication quite well until 2019. And then it got worse and I started having blackouts. And my medication was changed. But then this year, I suddenly had petit mal seizures. How can something like, first of all, how do you develop myoclonic dystonia? And how can that go from there to being epilepsy?
Hi, Tessa. Okay, well, let's look at the COVID question first. Some of those symptoms do sound pretty similar to what people are describing, and it could well be that you have had it, but bear in mind they're also quite non-specific symptoms and there are lots of viruses going around, so you may well have had something else as an alternative. So we don't know for sure. How could we tell? Well, if we did the test for have I got coronavirus infection right now, that would certainly be negative because this was months ago. And as far as we know, you're only infected and carrying the virus unless you have some other underlying health problem like an immune suppressive problem. You only have the infection for a short period of time, as in a couple of weeks. So how could we tell then? Well, we could do an antibody test. And there are now a number of tests that will look in the bloodstream for antibodies specific to the new coronavirus. And the rationale is that if you have had an infection, you have fought it off, and you have recovered, I know you, notwithstanding the symptoms you said you had, then that must mean your immune system has worked and you've made an immune response against the virus. If you've made an immune response, you will have done two things. One, you'll have made some antibodies, which are small molecules that wash around in the bloodstream and are sticky and can recognize things, bind onto them and neutralize them. The other is you'll have made white blood cells called T cells, which are also essential in helping the immune system to fight off infection. Now, the antibody tests look in the bloodstream to see if there are antibodies there that would recognize the new coronavirus. And one possibility would be to go and have one of these antibody tests. But bear in mind, we don't know yet how good they are. I'm not saying that the manufacturers aren't doing a good job. Mm. It's just that at the moment, we don't know how long people who've had the infection remain and cleared it, remain positive for an antibody test. And we don't know what fraction of people who have the infection and clear it actually have antibodies that these tests can detect, because those are two open questions at the moment. And so if you do get a positive antibody test, that's very helpful. It has a good predictive value. But if you get a negative test, it doesn't rule out the possibility that you did still have coronavirus. You just don't have detectable antibodies that test is looking for. So that would be the caveat. In terms of you talked about you mentioned you had dystonias. This sort of thing can come on in later life. It is common that it does. Not everyone gets these things from birth. Some people get these things when they get a bit older, and it can be the luck of the draw. I don't know the situation in your case, and I haven't heard of it being caused by or linked to epilepsy. So it may well be that, in fact, the two effects are completely separate from one another, that you got one thing and then the epilepsy was going to happen anyway, or it could be that there's some underlying connection. I don't know.
Thanks, Chris. And another question regarding blood pressure coming from Vaughan. Go ahead and ask your question to Chris. He's listening.
Thank you. Please, can you tell me...
Vaughan? Hello, Vaughan. We're going to have to come back to Vaughan again. The line's not being the best this afternoon, which is equally frustrating. But maybe in the meantime, let's try Musime.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Musime. Your question for Chris?
Yes, Chris, I have a question. Just on my observation, I've realized that only women on Earth, actually, is giving birth to babies with an umbilical cord attached to them. Why is it?
Could you get that question, Chris?
Can you just summarize that? Because it's a slightly dodgy line.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying why is it that women give birth to, in fact, humans are the only ones who give birth to a woman with an giving birth to babies with umbilical cord attached to the mother?
And it's a critical thing because that is your lifeline to your mum when you're developing as a baby. babies develop inside the uterus, inside a bag of fluid called the amniotic sac. And the baby develops from a ball of cells that started off as just that single fertilized egg. And the egg grows initially to form a bigger ball of cells. And then the cells segregate into cells around the outside with a mass of cells in the middle. The cells around the outside are going to form the amniotic sac and this placenta. The placenta looks like a big pancake. It's a big meaty pancake. And when a baby's born and you look at the placenta, it looks like liver. And that plugs into the wall of the uterus, the womb, and it grows in and attaches very strongly to the wall of the uterus. And it has the effect of bringing the blood of the mum very close to the blood of the developing baby so that the two don't mix, but they can swap chemicals that are in them. And the mum brings in with her blood oxygen, which is dumped into the baby's bloodstream, and the baby dumps all of its waste products like carbon dioxide and other metabolic breakdown products that it can't yet get rid of itself into the mum's blood, and then mum's blood takes those away, cleans them up, and throws the stuff away. So the baby develops in this bag of fluid floating on this umbilical cord, which is basically connected to the placenta and came from the same cells that formed the placenta. And when a baby is born, the amniotic bag that the baby's growing in, full of fluid, ruptures. The baby comes out through the cervix with the umbilical cord still attached. And once the baby is right out, at that point, as the baby takes its first breath, then various changes happen in the way that the circulatory system is working, and the baby starts oxygenating its blood for itself with its own lungs, and the blood supply going to the placenta up inside the mum cuts off. And at that point, we tie the cord off or clamp it and cut it, and then the blood vessels in there very quickly clench down and disappear, and they just become a fibrous ligament inside the tummy. You can follow it back up inside the tummy where it once was, going to the liver, but it closes off completely. And then the next stage of labour begins, which is that the mum, having just gone through the business of having to have the baby, then has to deliver the placenta as well, because that then has meanwhile detached from the wall of the uterus. And a very magical thing happens that means all the blood supply cuts off, usually. It's incredible. And then out comes the placenta. So all babies and all animals are born with the umbilical cord attached. We cut ours off generally, animals bite theirs off, but there's this very magical mechanism that means that the blood supply very quickly shuts down, so there's minimal blood loss, and some animals eat their placentas because it's a rich way of getting lots of iron back into the body. Some humans do that as well, other people throw them away.
And just like that, our time with Chris Smith comes to an end. Unfortunately, we had about two dodgy lines and some of you could not pose your questions to Chris Smith, our Naked Scientist. But thank you so much for your time as usual, Chris. And have yourself a good afternoon and we'll meet again next week.
I should do that. And we must get Vaughan back next week. So, yes. Vaughan, if you're listening, give us a ring next week, hopefully on a slightly better line, and we'll answer your question about blood pressure.
Thank you so much, Chris. And it's a minute before 3 o'clock.